Good evening, everyone, and good evening to everyone on the cloud Zendo. Welcome. And when it's getting chilly, feels like winter will finally arrive in the next day or two, maybe. Well, I think as most people know, but maybe not all, we're now as our Eno announced, on the second of a Dharma series that we're doing on vows, making vows, and particularly focusing on vows in the Buddhist tradition. What is the role, where do they come from, and how might they help our practice as we take up this challenging effort to really look deeply at our lives, to decide on what direction do I wish this life to go? And what do I do about all the crap that keeps coming at me? So last week we started to get a handle on what we mean by vow, some general understanding of what we're talking about, at least what I'm talking about, just so we have a common view of what a vow may be. And I don't think it's really important that we try to come to a really clear definition of what a vow is. And we may not all agree on the nuances of whatever definitions each one of us comes up with. But I hope we can agree on some of the general qualities of a vow. And again, particularly within the Buddhist tradition. And some of the qualities that I talked about last week are that vows are an expression of one's deepest aspiration. They are acts of the imagination. We can imagine, we can see some quality that we want to bring into the world, that we want to manifest in our life. And acts of imagination and acts of courage. And finally, perhaps a little more harder to understand, but I think vows in the Buddhist tradition are limitless in scope. In other words, they are open-ended, usually with us until our last breath. An example I gave last week was you may have a goal of becoming a doctor, for example, and you work really hard through high school, through college, through all the training, and then finally you get your certificate. Now that is a good goal and a powerful goal, but the vow that lies behind that, maybe, a vow may be rather to ease the suffering of others. And that will never end. Becoming a doctor, once you become a doctor, it kind of ended, right? It did that. But to ease the suffering of others, you'll be doing that when you're 80, 90. So as we look at this practice in the Buddhist tradition of making vows, I'm going to refer to this book. Here now and again, this is the vow, the vow powered life by the Zen teacher Jan Chosen Bays, and I talked about this last week a little bit. She's the one of the co-abbot of the Great Vow Monastery down in Portland, or outside Portland, but in Oregon. And she explores vows as a practice in some depth, and she shows with many examples in here. When vows are really made with a conscious intention, they become a conduit for the energy of one's life. So, thinking about vows, it's pretty clear that they arise from different places, different times in our life. Some vows we inherit from our parents, our godparents, maybe the culture in which we're raised. In Norman's book, Zokitz Norman Fisher's book, taking our places. Norman writes of one of his childhood vows that arose for him as he sat in a synagogue classroom, learning about the very sad and yet very inspiring stories of the Jewish martyrs. And here's what Norman wrote. "I felt myself sitting in my seat at that moment as though it were an eternal moment. And I thought, I will be like that too. I will never give up what I am, never give up what I know to be so, because someone else tries to force me so. I felt that because of what people before me had endured in being true to their deepest identities and commitments, I too would endure and remain steadfast in their honor and in their name. As a Jewish child listening to a Jewish tale, I felt a vow come upon me to hold fast to being a Jew, no matter what, a vow I have always kept in my heart. Despite the fact I have practiced Buddhism for so long." Norman's vow is one that comes perhaps part from his family, from the religious tradition that his family was connected to with, from the stories that were told from the family and in the religious community. A kind of inherited vow, perhaps we could say. Children often make vows and carry them for many years, if not a lifetime, even though they may not be able to articulate them well. Perhaps as a child, you vowed not to be like one of your parents, or not to be like that older sibling, or to be like that favorite uncle or favorite aunt. Some vows in childhood arise in response to a lack, a pain and suffering. My mother, when she was a little girl, struggled with her own mother's sharp criticism and tight-fistedness. As a young girl, she decided she would never afflict her own children that way. When I was growing up, my family had very little money. Often we were eating tuna fish casserole, a can of tuna fish mixed with instant rice warmed up in the oven, or baked spaghetti casserole, which was Campbell's tomato soup and pasta baked in an oven. I can't face tuna fish casserole today. But my mother was as generous with her children's allowances as she could be. To live a life of generosity for others was one of her childhood vows. And it was one that was a force all throughout her life. She loved nothing better than to go to the mall and buy bed sheets for somebody, or socks for somebody, and then maybe take them back and get a different pair, another set of bed sheets, and then send them off. That's one way. In the second chapter of, again, The Vow-Powered Life, Chosen writes about what she calls inspired vows. Inspired vows that arise from a person that we meet or a situation that was very deeply touching to us. She writes, "I've pondered how and why people make radical changes in their lives, and it seems to occur in two ways, through sufficient suffering or through sufficient inspiration. If we suffer enough, we may become desperate enough to try another way of living in the world. A tiny bit of good is enough to spark a transformation. And then stories of life-changing inspiration show that it could be anyone or anything that catalyzes such a change. A book, a speech, a teacher, a mentor, an inner voice, a chance meeting, an offhand comment. I think one contemporary example of this is Harada Roshi, a Japanese Rinzai Zen priest who is abbot of Sogenji Temple in Okayama, Japan, and also of the Tahoma Monastery on Whidbey Island, just across the border in Washington. He was inspired to start serious Zen practice as a young man by simply seeing a person on the bus. And this is how he describes it. Is this decaf coffee or? No, just kidding. He writes, one day in high school, I was on an errand to the Zen temple called Myoshinji, this is in Kyoto, for my father. I boarded a bus at rush hour, and towards the back, I noticed an old priest in robes, reading a book. As I stood in the aisle, I was deeply moved by this man who seemed so deep and so still and radiated such a brightness of spirit. In comparison, the people around him seemed melancholy, weighed down by their thoughts and their cares. I decided to see where he'd get off. He left the bus at Myoshinji, exactly as I did. And much later, I learned that this was Mumon Roshi, a very famous teacher during and right after the war, the abbot of Shofukuji Monastery in Kobe and the president of Hanazono College, the Rinzai Colleges in Kyoto. Now, one more other thing I'll say about Mumon Roshi is at the end of the war, he traveled throughout Southeast Asia apologizing for the atrocities done by the Japanese Imperial Army. The only Rinzai Zen priest to ever do such an act at that time. Anyway, Harada Roshi continues, I doubt I would have become a monk if I had not met Mumon Roshi. Because of him, I realized how a person's inner qualities can shine clearly from their entire being. So after graduating from college, I entered Shofukuji to train under Mumon Roshi. The Buddhist tradition from the very beginning has honored the practice of making vows. Some of the earliest Buddhist texts say that Shakyamuni, after he experienced the four sights, remember that story of the four sights, right? Sickness, old age, death, and the peaceful continence of a monk, a wandering monk. He realized the truth of impermanence and the ultimate dissatisfaction of this kind of conditioned existence. And at that point, he vowed to find an answer or a response to the inherent suffering in human life. So from that point, from that on, the Buddhist history and lore is filled with examples and stories of individuals who through their strong vows, overcome great obstacles to awaken. Two of the most famous of these stories are in the Jitaka tales. There are stories of Shakyamuni's previous lives. Very interesting reading. I think Rafi did a book on some of them, the children's storyteller. At any rate, here's one. Two I'll talk about. In an earlier life, long before he was born as Siddhartha Gautama, he was a merchant who had a blind mother. And one day, the boat they were on while traveling together sank, and finding himself in water, the merchant looked around for his mother and eventually, with the aid of a plank, saved her from drowning. At that moment, seeing how all beings were essentially lost and suffering, like he was and his mother were, they had both nearly drowned, he vowed to help save all sentient beings. And this is said to be the beginning vow that eventually led to Siddhartha Gautama's birth and his deep desire to help others awaken. And then again, according to another of these Jataka tales, Sumedha, a young Brahmin who rejected all of his family's great wealth to take up religious practice in the traditional Indian way, was wandering the subcontinent, meeting various teachers and practicing. He was very sincere, and at one point in his practice, he withdrew to a nearby forest to live as a hermit, as was another custom of religious practice at that time. And this was the time, the very moment, when Dipamkara Buddha appeared in the world and was teaching. And this was, of course, eons before Shakyamuni Buddha was born. So there are a number of Buddhas that appeared in the world, at least in the Buddhist tradition. They talk about all these different Buddhas. So Sumedha heard that Dipamkara was coming to a nearby village. So he left his hermitage and traveled to that village. And so moved by seeing the sincerity and presence of Dipamkara walk into the village and hearing him teach, Sumedha vowed at that point, "I too will strive to become an enlightened one with all the qualities of a perfect Buddha. I too will teach the Dharma as this Dipamkara Buddha has done just now, having freed myself from the cycle of birth and death and gained some supreme happiness. I too will lead others to the same goal." The story goes on that as Dipamkara Buddha was walking, perhaps leaving the village, and was about to step in a puddle, Sumedha undid his hair, his long hair, which was tied up in a knot, and laid it across the mud puddle so that Dipamkara Buddha would not step in it. Dipamkara Buddha stopped and looked into the heart of Sumedha and predicted that he would become a Buddha in another lifetime. There are many Jataka tales like this, where vowing is portrayed as really a vital part of the practice over and over and over again. There is an expression in Japanese that really highlights this, I think, centrality of making vows in the Buddhist tradition. In Japanese, it's Gosho no Bonpu, Gasho no Bosatsu. And indeed, some teachers say that this short sentence is the very definition of a bodhisattva. And bodhisattva, in case you're not familiar with that term, is one who practices to awaken for the sake of others, in a nutshell. We'll talk more about the bodhisattva and the bodhisattva vows a little bit later. Anyway, Shohaku Okumura, in his book called Living by Vow, another wonderful book I highly recommend, translates this Japanese sentence like this. Ordinary people are those who live being pulled by their karma. Bodhisattvas are those who live led by their vows. Pulled by their karma. Well, karma is a topic for another seminar. But here, maybe we can think about karma as our own delusions. Pettiness, craving, frustration, rage, confusion, envy. Our own woundedness. All of which pushes and pulls us about as we live our life. Bodhisattvas live led by their vows. Mahayana Buddhism teaches that anyone, even ordinary people like you and me, can be bodhisattva. The key factor is to arouse, in Sanskrit what's called bodhicitta, the aspiration to awaken in order to help all beings. And traditionally, this is expressed in the bodhisattva vow, not to awaken, not to become a Buddha until everyone else goes before you and is awake, fully awake. And they're all Buddhas, and then, okay, I'll become a Buddha too. Once everyone else in the whole universe is a Buddha, okay, then it will be my turn. So no matter how deep and rich their own practice is, bodhisattvas vow to stay in this world of samsara, this world of suffering, to support all beings in whatever way is necessary. And the Buddhist literature, all the sutras are filled with vows made by the archetypal bodhisattvas and Buddhas. So let me give you a couple of examples here. Avalokiteshvara, or Kannon in Japanese, is the bodhisattva of compassion, the very essence of compassion. And Avalokiteshvara vowed to end suffering in the world, to be with whoever called her name, to listen deeply and respond with compassion. Indeed, one of her names is she who listens, who hears the deep cries of the world. Another archetypal bodhisattva is Samantabhadra, the bodhisattva of awakened activity, representing the shining function of wisdom in the world and the interconnectedness of all beings. That's Samantabhadra. Now, in the text, Samantabhadra is known to have made a set of 10 vows, some of which are to confess all misdeeds, to rejoice in the happiness of others, to study the Dharma, but also to give any merit that comes from any activity away to other people. Whatever merit I give freely. And then another archetypal bodhisattva is Kshitagarbha, or in Japanese, Jizo. Jizo Bodhisattva. Jizo Bodhisattva vowed to be present for all the suffering beings in all the six realms of this universe. That includes, in the traditional Buddhist view of the universe, the god realm, the demigod realm, the human realm, the animal realm, the hungry ghost realm, and the hell realm. Jizo travels all these realms, helping whoever needs help. And this means Jizo is very close and accessible to everybody, no matter what state you're in. You're in a hell realm, Jizo, help me. And although Jizo is not widely known in the West, Jizo is much loved in Japan and regarded as the protector of women and the protector of children. And there's many stories about Jizo, which I won't go into it right now. And then the last one I just want to talk about is Amida, or Amitabha Buddha, Amida in Japanese. And that means infinite light, or infinite radiance, the name itself. And this is an archetypal Buddha who lives in this place called the Western Paradise, or Western Pure Land. And this Buddha made 48 vows, which you can read about. It's in one of the sutras. But the primary vow was to enable the liberation of all sentient beings by giving aid to anyone who called out to Amitabha Buddha. And in Japanese, the way of expressing this is Namu Amida Butsu. Namu Amida Butsu. Now, not only the archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, but even the great teachers and practitioners of the past also made very profound and very inspiring vows. Shantideva, an 8th century in the Common Era Indian philosopher, great Buddhist monk and teacher and scholar, in fact, very influential in our own Buddhist tradition. This is his vow. May I become at all times, both now and forever, a protector of those without protection, a guide for those who have lost their way, a ship for those with oceans to cross, a bridge for those with rivers to cross, a sanctuary for those in danger, and a lamp for those without light, a place for refuge for those who lack shelter. It goes on. And then, of course, there is the famous vow, Bodhisattva vows, the famous Bodhisattva vow of the Dalai Lama. Maybe you've heard this before. It's expressed in a poem, again, by that classic Buddhist teacher and philosopher, Shantideva. And this is what the Dalai Lama wrote. My favorite aspiration is this. For as long as space endures, and for as long as living beings remain, until then may I too abide to dispel the misery of the world. And then the Dalai Lama continues, and in trying to fulfill that vow, I feel my life has been of some benefit. Very moving, eh? Now, on a little more mundane level, Shohaku Okumura, the same teacher in this book, speculates that this great desire to help others is why the great Tang Dynasty Chinese Zen teacher, Guishan Lingyo, told his students that he would be reborn as a water buffalo. And it kind of shocked his students, right? Great Zen teacher, what? You're going to be reborn as a water buffalo? But Guishan replied, the humble water buffalo spends much time walking in the muddy fields to help farmers grow their rice. Therefore, I will be reborn as a water buffalo. I don't know if anyone else in the world has wanted to do that. So this practice of making vows can be vast and very sweeping, as some of the examples we've just read, shaping the deepest part of what it means to be human and alive in this world. But vows can also be valuable aids to us as we deal with the ups and downs of our daily life. Vows can bring us back into awareness of the interconnectedness of all things. And one wonderful practice with vows is to write and remember gathas. Gathas are short poems we can recite during the day when the need arises to help us dwell in mindfulness and affirm over and over again how we want to live. Let me give you some examples. Well, then I'm going to ask you to maybe write some of your own. So these are examples from a book called The Dragon Who Never Sleeps, Verses for Zen Buddhist Practice by Robert Aiken. When I panic at losing my bearings, I vow with all beings to acknowledge the error is panic, not losing familiar ground. When my efforts are clearly outclassed, I vow with all beings to face my own limitations and bring forth my original self. When hatred stirs in my heart, I vow with all beings to remember Kanzeon, Avalokiteshvara, Kanmon, and offer my life to her. Whenever I'm tempted to judge, I vow with all beings to remember we both have two nostrils and the same implacable fate. When greed stirs in my heart, I vow with all beings to realize the end of suffering and make an offering to Buddha. So I've been talking quite a bit about the role of vows and history of vows in the Buddhist tradition, and I figured, well, you know, it's time to kind of bring this down to earth. And so I'd like you to work on some gathas, your own vows. And they not big, heart-wrenching vows of, you know, what you're going to dedicate the rest of your life to. Although that could, if you're in, you're up for that, go ahead. But just what smaller vows can you make that will help you in your daily life? And so I'm going to pass out this paper. And can you share a screen, that one that's already on the desktop for those? And also, I think I sent out a chat link so people can bring it up that way as well. So if you go to share screen, there we are, that green one in the middle there. Bring the cursor down to the bottom of the page. There we are. Yeah. And and then you click share screen to share at the end there, yeah? Did that work? Yep. No, that's not it. Oh, that's it. Is that it? Yes, that's it. It's a different format.
Okay.
Great. Sorry, could I have one more copy? Sorry, thanks. Okay. So as it says here in the text, gathas.
It's really messed up.
It's messed up?
We can't see the screen share any longer.
So if you bear with me a second here.
And also the link doesn't work because we don't have permission.
Sorry about that.
It's okay.
It's on the screen. It is on the screen now.
It's on the screen now?
Yes.
Okay, so it's okay?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Good. Give me a thumbs up if it's okay. Onsen, I can see you. I can't see anyone else. Good. Okay, so that's fine. Let's leave it. Good.
Don't touch it.
Don't, no touching. Okay. So these are just four more examples. I picked two from Thich Nhat Hanh and two from Eckhart Roshi. How about somebody else read these for me? Mel, would you read the Turning on the Water?
Thich Nhat Hanh, Turning on the Water. Water comes from high mountain sources. Water turns deep in the earth. Miraculously, water comes to us and sustains all life.
Good, thank you. And could you read the next one?
Washing your hands. Water flows over these hands. May I use them skillfully to preserve our precious planet.
Yeah, good. Then let's go to Robert Aikens. Would you read one?
Sure. When I see flowing water, I vow with all beings to develop a wholesome will and wash away the stains of delusion.
Mm-hmm. And I'll just read the last one. Offering water to Buddha, I vow with all beings to honor your fathomless wellspring, sustaining great life and great death. So what I'd like us to do is to write, and I'll give you some pens as well.
I already passed them out.
Oh, you passed them out, good. A couple of gathas for your own use, following the kind of three steps here that I included. So people on Zoom, hopefully you have a pen or something not too far away. So I should have mentioned to ask you to get that sooner, and a paper. But this is take a few moments and write. So the first line, beginning when or whenever. The second line, I vow with all beings. And the last two lines, what are you vowing? What will be the action of your vow? Think about, that again doesn't be anything too earth-shattering, but maybe something that you would really like to change or to have a fresh approach with.